From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson. My co-host Chris Cherniak is taking a little time off, so guest host Katie Wang is here to fill in.
Always happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And joining us now for the first part of the show today is Ken Raitt. He's the project director at the Pew Charitable Trust and is here to talk with us about all of these environment-related actions that have been taken by the Biden administration. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Ken.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, as I referenced in our intro, the news from the White House as it relates to climate and the environment has been coming fast and furious. And, you know, I think in the environmental community, there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. And we're hoping that you can kind of help us, help ground us today and understand what kind of the reality on the ground is going to look like now that these major announcements have been made. The first question that I want to ask you is, you know, have there been any surprises, anything in this news that has surprised you so far?
You know, I think the only thing that's surprising is just the speed with which this administration, the Biden administration, is moving. I mean, there is a long list of things that happened during the prior 4 years during the Trump administration that really moved the country in the wrong direction on the environment and specifically on public lands. And so, you know, the Biden administration has no time to waste. They are professionals. They realize that, you know, the clock is ticking. And I'm frankly pleased to see the speed with which they are moving. So there's a whole number of issues that we can talk about today where this is particularly relevant.
Well, let's start digging into some of those issues. You mentioned public lands in particular. We know that there's been action on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the Tongass. Tell us where those issues stand now.
So the prior administration, in its rush to lease lands in the Arctic Refuge and in its rush to create the last of our old growth forests available for timber and exports to Pacific Rim nations, opened both the Arctic Refuge and roadless areas in the Tongass National Forest to logging. And the administration has released a couple of policy documents in its first 2 weeks outlining the steps it's going to take to remedy these problems. And it's not just, we have to keep in mind, it's not just, we can't just spend all of our time remedying the numerous problems and the chaos the Trump administration created in public lands, but there's also a proactive agenda that needs to be established and run through. And so this administration, the Biden administration, has a pretty full plate because the Trump administration created such chaos in how public lands are managed, to both clean that up and then set forth a positive conservation vision and direction for the next 4 years ahead. So they announced that they're going to be suspending any further leasing in the Arctic Refuge, that they are going to initiate a review of the decision to open roadless areas on the Tongass. And so we are looking forward to that process. And then as it relates to lands in Utah, Utahns are no strangers to the actions, the decisions made by the Trump administration to unravel the really important protections created both in the Clinton administration and the conservation of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and then later in the Obama administration with the protection of the Bears Ears National Monument. And during his time in office, President Trump dramatically decreased the size of both of these national monuments, and the administration made very clear in their first days that they are going to initiate a review process to reconsider these decisions. That's obviously a step that we strongly support because these national monuments should be restored to at least the size they were upon their initial creation.
Ken, I was wondering if you could kind of explain for our audience. I know there's been a lot of interest and excitement as the Biden administration took office. A lot of executive orders were signed, and people were kind of cheering on the sidelines, you know, saying, "Great, you know, just turn over everything Trump did, and that'll be kind of the end of it." And you know, I think it's certainly more complicated than that, as you're alluding to. And I guess, you know, I think it'd be helpful for the audience to hear, you know, why is it important that, as you talk about, that it's a process and not just kind of a, you know, an executive signing of an order, kind of what the differences, kind of the nuances between those two types of actions, because certainly the inclination would be like, okay, just, you know, restore everything to as it was, but that's not always perhaps, you know, is that the best path? And kind of what that
means? Yeah, well, it's going to depend on the specific action. So like the Tongass roadless rule, the elimination of the Tongass roadless rule went through what is called a federal rulemaking process. And so once it goes through a public process that is done through public notice and comment, you can't just issue an executive order to overturn that. That would make that overturning of that decision legally vulnerable. And so the administration needs to go back through a rulemaking process to get it done the right way. Something like the Grand Staircase and Bears Ears, that could be done basically with the stroke of a pen. However, President Biden is interested in a process to do that, to better understand what it was that motivated the Trump decision to dramatically decrease the size of these things. And if it was found that those decisions really had no merit, which is how we view it, then we are both hopeful and confident that the original size of those monuments will be reestablished. And so really the fix is going to be dependent on the process that was used by the Trump folks to create the chaos, because there are processes that have to be gone through in order to get these things done correctly.
And so does that make it more durable? I mean, I think there's always the fear, while you can kind of cheer on the sidelines for the executive orders, there's always that fear that the next administration may not be pro-environment,
right? That's a good question. I mean, you know, and you know, there were so many firsts in the Trump administration. I think we're all still trying to count the number of firsts and the amount of chaos that was created. Mm-hmm. I mean, whoever would have thought that Grand Staircase that was at that point, 20-some-odd years old, that it would be undone. I mean, the economies of Kane and Garfield County totally during the last two decades transitioned to an economy built around the protection of that magnificent landscape. That's not to say that those economies were ever geared for the coal development in the Kaparowitz Plateau. It was being considered in the early 1990s. That was one of the factors that led to the original creation of that national monument. So, yeah, I mean, they're getting back to your original question, there is great interest in making sure that these decisions are durable and that we're not going to end up in this situation where protections will be created and then disappear, kind of like ping pong from Republican to Democratic administration. And we're certainly hopeful that once we get the Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase restored, those places will be protected for future generations.
Are you hopeful as well about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? That's one that just kind of pierced my heart. I used to work with some researchers on that land, and just to hear about
Yeah, I mean, there are so many reasons why oil development in the North Slope of Alaska just doesn't make sense. As we find ourselves firmly in the grip of climate change, and this is the most vulnerable of landscapes up in Alaska, and so we're hopeful that we will be able to restore the protections. There are, however, leases that were issued by the Trump administration as they sought to kind of rush to get some of public assets into private hands. And so that will need to be dealt with. Some of those the vast majority of those are held by the state of Alaska. And we're also hopeful that we will see the roadless protections on the Tongass restored The Tongass is part of the largest temperate rainforest in the northern hemisphere. You know, it harbors as much carbon as 8% of all the forests in the country, and so it becomes a really important carbon sink that needs to be preserved in its old growth state, both for the benefit of the carbon cycle and for the five salmon species that live there, for more than a dozen tribal communities who have depended on the Tongass in its natural state since time immemorial. So for all these reasons, we need to get these protections restored. But then also, we need to keep our eye on the ball of what the proactive agenda of the Biden administration was. And you mentioned during your introduction the 30 by 30 piece, which is to protect 30% of the nation's lands and waters by the year 2030. And that is an ambitious goal, to be sure.
You know, I was surprised to see that and hear that. I think, you know, so often we hear about climate-specific goals now, and certainly this is an important piece of protecting our climate. But I don't know, as far as I know, I've never heard like a presidential administration talk about a land conservation goal. Is that accurate, or is there a precedent here?
Well, former administrations have talked about goals. I mean, my goodness, back in, I think it was the 1940s, then Secretary Harold Ickes suggested that we protect the vast majority of southern Utah in a national park. And so that was kind of a grand vision that had been laid out. In terms of kind of these numerical metrics, this may be the first time, but keep in mind, E.O. Wilson, who is a Harvard educator and kind of the grandfather of conservation biology, has called for 50% of the lands and waters to be protected across the earth. So, you know, while 30 by 30 seems an ambitious goal, it may actually be quite reasonable with regards to something that we may be able to accomplish. So we're interested to see how the administration moves forward with this, both in policy and in the things that they're able to get done.
You know, that was going to be my next question for you, Ken. This is this big, broad goal. What does that mean on the ground? Do you have any sense of what some steps might be from the federal government in getting toward that?
Well, I think that we're going to get a clear idea of this in the next couple of months, because the order that was released on the 27th outlines a process whereby the Departments of Agriculture and Interior prepare reports back to the president about the things that they can do in order to move us towards this goal. And so, you know, at this point, it would be a little hypothetical to say where we're going to head with this. But, you look at lands managed by the Forest Service, at lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management, in particular, the Bureau of Land Management has always been a very development-focused agency. And we saw just how far that can possibly go during the Trump administration. I mean, make no mistake, every single thing the Trump administration did during its 4 years on Bureau of Land Management lands was to benefit the president's energy dominance agenda. And so everything was done to open all of the lands. And so, you know, in many ways, I think a move to 30 by 30, in particular on BLM lands, may result in a responsible balance in how our public lands are managed, because right now we aren't even close.
You know, it's interesting to kind of see the cycles. I think although the Reagan administration probably wasn't quite as bad as as the Trump administration environmentally, but it does seem like there's kind of a cyclical nature to how our lands are being managed, and certainly the development that's on there. I'm interested in kind of your perspective. I mean, certainly we don't know much yet but kind of how that, you know, the collaborations that might be formed with, you know, organizations like yours and other land conservation organizations. You know, there's so much research that's going on about how wildlife can be protected, how wildlands can be connected to each other, you know, with wildlife corridors. And, you know, there's kind of the finer details that kind of go beyond a policy level that perhaps could persist over time. And so we don't keep, maybe the cycles get smaller, right? We don't keep going back quite so far.
Yeah.
So that
we don't have such broad oscillations in the pendulum. Is that, that's what you're saying?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious what kind of thing you think about that. You know, the potential.
And so one example I'd look to in this is the sage-grouse plans that were promulgated during the Obama administration and finalized in 2015. This was a landscape-scale conservation effort to basically to provide balance in how our sage steppe across the interior West is managed, and this involved lands in Utah as well. And what the administration came out with was a massive landscape-scale blueprint for how these lands should be managed. And yes, it meant that, you know, some areas were going to be protected from the impacts of oil and gas development. And yes, oil and gas development could occur in other areas. And it was really hailed as a collaborative, a model of collaboration between the state and federal governments and between private landowners and whatnot. And it really actually solved a problem that short-circuited what may have otherwise been a listing of the sage-grouse under the Endangered Species Act. So in many ways, you know, in all ways, this was actually a win-win. And then the Trump administration just came in and tried to wipe that whole effort clean. They were not successful in the end. They were held up by court injunctions that came out of Idaho that put that in spite of what the Trump administration tried to do, that left the 2015 plans intact. And so, you know, there was a whole lot of chaos that occurred around the sage-grouse plans in the last 4 years. But the 2015 plans remain intact, and that's really a good model for collaboration, which is a good way to go forward as we seek out conservation goals in the future.
So I do want to talk, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I do want to talk a little bit more about some of these energy-related goals. We heard that, you know, we are setting a goal to end carbon pollution from power plants by 2035. You know, is that realistic? It sounds like a huge goal. Are we on track for that now? And if not, like, what kinds of changes are going to need to happen?
So I can't speak specifically to the power plant piece, since that's outside of my area of expertise. But keep in mind, oftentimes, you know, there are audacious goals that are laid out, and then we move incrementally in the right direction. And then over time, kind of the economics, the economies of scale grab hold and actually move whole sectors of our economy in a positive direction. And then we're actually able to move in that direction in ways that we never could have foreseen. You know, you think about it's not just, you know, power plants, but also we're hearing that, you know, we may be phasing out internal combustion engines from cars produced in Detroit by 2035. I mean, whoever would have thought that was going to actually really happen? And so, you know, you lay out these goals, and then the technology kind of wraps itself around the vision, and then we find ourselves in a situation where we may actually be able to get there. So I'm just encouraged that we are at a time in history where we have great vision for a sustainable future, and I have confidence in the power of technology to help us get us there.
So I'm curious about the international response that we're seeing to, you know, this plethora of announcements over the last couple of weeks. What are you hearing from the international community?
Well, I think people are guardedly optimistic. I mean, it's been a long 4 years, and America has found itself isolated, you know, in so many ways in the international community. And you know, as I've read the response from conservation organizations internationally, there's guarded optimism that the United States can reestablish its role as a visionary leader that can help not just move forward policy in our own country, but globally as well. Because for us to solve these problems, climate change, you know, we can't do it on our own. We have to be part of an international community that has the same goals and deploys its resources in a way that move us collectively towards a good end. And I don't think that we were in any kind of shape to do that during the Trump years, since we found ourselves so isolated.
Well, one last question. You know, as we look forward over the next couple of months, what can our listeners kind of expect to see? Do you expect to hear additional goals, or are we looking at kind of the details of how these things are going to be played out? And then kind of as a second piece of that, if people are interested in getting involved, what ways do you recommend that they do that?
So as I mentioned earlier, over the course of the next couple of months, the administration is going to be really putting the details together about how it intends to get to these audacious goals. And we're going to see specific proposals laid out by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that includes the Forest Service, the Department of Interior, that includes Bureau of Land Management. And, you know, people can stay abreast of these issues by visiting us at our website, www.pewtrusts.org. And also, I think that people ought to be writing to their governor and to their congresspeople and encouraging that they give these things a chance and not just kind of jump into their partisan places of opposing simply because of who's in the White House. You know, we've had too much of that in this country. And, you know, I think with the election last year, or with the election last year proved, since we basically saw a change in the control of both the White House and the Senate, is that Americans were not happy with the course the country had been going in. And so my hope is that Utah governor, the Utah senators can be part of the solution rather than just standing in opposition to the solution.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for sharing your insight with us this morning. It's time for us to wrap up. But again, your website one more time?
Pewtrusts.org, PEWTRUSTS.org.
Well, that was Ken Raitt, Project Director at the Pew Charitable Trust. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.